Welcome to our discussion segment on the Khmer Rouge. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Let's get started. Well,
happy birthday, old man.
Thank you very much. That's not quite the tone I was going to start with on this particular podcast.
Sorry, I had to start with something light.
Well, you know what? I appreciate that very much in terms of starting something light, considering this was probably, would you consider it worse than Vlad the Impaler in terms of history?
In terms of numbers, I don't know. It's hard to say which is worse, you know, impaling infants on their mothers or dashing babies' heads against trees. I don't know.
Let's just both agree they're equally worse.
Yeah, both caused me to lose sleep. I think if I was replanning out the last two seasons, we would have done hero, villain, hero, villain, hero, villain, instead of a whole season on villains, because, man, I am ready for this season to be over.
Yeah, and that's not because of any other reason than the topic,
sure.
But
yeah.
I like that we started out this season with framing up evil, not just going into the deep end like we warned you all we would do.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are. I guess my first question, John, is what was their end game? What were they trying to accomplish through this mass genocide?
The Khmer Rouge wanted to create what Pol Pot and some of the other leaders called an agrarian socialist utopia, where all of the proletariat, all of the working people would be farmers, because they viewed that as the best way. Well, okay, so we got to look at this from their propaganda and from what we now know were their real goals. Their propaganda said, this is how we make Cambodia a worker's paradise. All of you do very simple tasks, simple labor on the farms, and we will take care of the rest. We who will remain in the cities, who will live in the lap of luxury, we will take care of you. What they actually wanted was what communists everywhere want, which is control. They believed they knew how to mold and reshape Cambodian society in a way that would benefit them at the expense of everyone else.
So they went into it with that intention. There wasn't a positive, I'll call it, intention. They were using that as a front in order to gain control.
I'm sure some of the people who joined the Khmer Rouge during the Civil War when they were rising to power, they probably thought, yeah, this is genuinely going to create a utopia. Most socialists and most communists throughout history who are not part of the deeply dedicated, educated in Marxism elites, they genuinely believe that this is the path to power. I mean, look at the average Twitter socialist and cable news communist. They, I think, genuinely believe that, oh, this is how we're going to create a more just and fair and equal society. Problem is, it doesn't work. It can't
work.
Not
ever.
Ever. Because it requires those in power to give up that power, which very few human beings have ever done. And if you don't believe in any concept of the divine, if you don't believe that there are consequences imposed on you by an external force, whether in this life or the next, you have no reason to give up your power. And therefore, scientific atheist leaders across the pages of history, to my knowledge, have never voluntarily given up their power. It has always been taken from them from the barrel of a gun, which ends with their bodies being burned on trash heaps.
Hmm.
And it causes me to wonder, I had many thoughts, many wonders at the end of the podcast. I wonder how many of the people who thought, oh, I'm joining this to really better myself and to better our society, were then seduced into thinking, oh, I'll be part of the elite, only to then find themselves be part of those who are purged. Because it's very common in socialist, communist, collectivist, whatever label you want to apply to it, those types of revolutions, they inevitably eat their own. We saw this when the Vietnamese communists invaded the Cambodian communist country. Revolutionary groups always purge either the young, or they purge not the old chronologically, but the old guard in the group, those who are not quote-unquote sufficiently revolutionary. And a lot of times, the people who think they're going to be, you know, leading the movement and they're going to be living their best life as an artist or as a painter or a poet or something like that, no, they're digging the ditches that their bodies will one day lie in.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that is borne out in every single communist revolution across the pages of history. And all the people today who think that when we bring about the revolution, when we create a socialist utopia in pick your country, we will be the ones in charge. No, you probably will also be digging a ditch that one day you will lie in.
Yeah. And it's interesting how communism rebrands itself over time.
Oh, yeah. it's amazing how successful they are at rebranding.
Yeah, I once saw a comic that somebody had drawn. It was in one of the papers, and there were people being lined up against a wall. And one of the people who was lined up and blindfolded, they said, "But wait, I protested for you. I voted for you. I did mm-hmm. all these things for you." And the guard who was about to open fire said, "Yeah, and you served your purpose."
Yep.
That's exactly how it was.
And once you no longer have a purpose, once the cog is no longer useful, it's removed. To keep you is no benefit. To kill you is no loss. Yeah.
So to take a step back a little bit, you spent a lot of time obviously talking about the genocide, as you should have, obviously. I was thinking about what was life like for those that survived, who were not part of the group that was mass murdered. I mean, what was it like to live there under that regime?
Well, nearly a quarter of the nation's population was killed. So the Khmer Rouge's brutality touched virtually every family in that country. So if you were part of the only group that wasn't, actually, no, even the Khmer Rouge was purged. Every group in the country was touched. So there was no one exempt. I think really life boiled down to we survived. It's a sense of simultaneous horror and gratitude. Horror at the loss of friends and loved ones, and gratitude that we kept our heads down and now we're living under a slightly kinder and gentler Vietnamese-style communist society, which you have to imagine how bad it was under the Khmer Rouge that they welcomed the North Vietnamese, who we talked about like a month and a half ago,
right,
as liberators. Mm. That's how bad the Khmer Rouge were.
Mm. Considering it was that bad, why was Pol Pot allowed to live after all of that happened? I know he left, but it seemed like he was taken care of. Is that fair? Like, did somebody pay for his expenses?
Only at the end of his career, only after the Khmer Rouge was thrown out of power. From 1979, I think, until the early 90s, he was basically a guerrilla fighter. So he is in the western part of the country, either politically or actively militarily resisting the government. So the party is taking care of him. And after he resigned his office, he's being taken care of by various friends. And I know for a fact he amassed a vast personal fortune. So, you know, he did fairly well for himself. So I'm sure he was able to pay for the best medical care towards the end of his life, the best servants, the best homes, best being a relative term given he's in political exile in a very rural part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how often the elites in collective societies, they do really, really well for themselves.
And in life, there doesn't seem to be a lot of consequences.
Yeah.
So at what point did the international community realize what was going on in Cambodia? And why, if they knew early on, was there no intervention?
I don't believe anyone knew until it was almost over.
And when exactly was that?
Late 1970s, 78, 79.
Okay.
I think it was, I'm pretty sure it was the Vietnamese who first uncovered all of the horrors of the killing fields. There were people who escaped who told their stories, but very similar to World War II, very similar to the Soviet genocide in Ukraine in the 1930s, very similar to the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward in China in the 1960s and 70s. Very few people in the West believed them. Because they thought in the West, in our comfort, even in the midst of the Cold War, it can't be that bad. Or, specifically in the United States, it was, well, that's too bad, but we're not going back to Southeast Asia. Because if you're talking about, you know, why was nothing done, you're talking about military intervention.
Yeah.
Vietnam ended in 1975. We're not going back there in 1978, 79. Not even to stop a genocide. The American people are done with that part of the world.
Yeah, but we weren't the only ones. I mean, if people were escaping, was it just that they were like, it's not that bad, you're lying?
No, I don't know that it was ever you're lying. I think it was, it's not that bad, or there's nothing we can do. I mean, the United Nations, I know, heard testimony from a number of people, so did various other international organizations. But you got to remember, at this time, the world is bipolar, pretty much. It's either the free world, dominated by the United States and Great Britain, France, the European powers, and the Soviet Union / communist China. Yeah, there's a rift there, but it's the free world and the communist world. The communist world is the ones doing this. The free world is busy trying to hold the lines in the 1970s against a communist diplomatic and military and economic onslaught in the third world. They don't have time or resources. in the eyes of most Western leaders, to deal with something in a country that's not easily accessible, and honestly, that's not all that geopolitically significant. Mm. I'm not defending their attitude, but that's the realistic approach based on everything that I read to, if they knew about it, here's why they didn't choose to intervene.
Mm. So the Vietnamese invade,
yes,
and they start to discover the killing fields and the effects of this purge. How does that leak out to the international community? And you talked about this in the podcast a bit, but I just wanted to drill down. Obviously, even the Vietnamese knew this was crazy. This was wrong.
Yes.
And so were they the ones who started to report on it? Did they invite journalists to take pictures? Did they take pictures and then share them? How did this get out in the world is my question.
It definitely got out with the cooperation of the Vietnamese puppet government that was set up in Phnom Penh. I don't know to what extent the Vietnamese government in Hanoi was involved in kind of disseminating all of this. I know that a lot of journalists, including the ones who were involved in writing the book and then the script for the movie, The Killing Fields, the movie came out in 1984, they snuck in and started interviewing survivors. It was not a coordinated PR campaign like what you see later on with other acts of genocide, thinking specifically what happened in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, or honestly, what's going on kind of in Ukraine, where you have a combination of social media and traditional media telling the stories of what's going on. It was very much, you know, these rugged, intrepid journalists, aid workers, and honestly, a lot of missionaries who are going in there, talking to these people, saying this needs to be shared with the world.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting when those stories started to come out, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the Gulag Archipelago was released in the early 80s, correct?
I believe so, yes.
So this was like consistently more and more things coming out about communism.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, I'm not quite sure who it was, but I read a quote that talked about the Gulag Archipelago. It set back the philosophy of communism for like 20 years because people realized this is what this is. This is always the end result.
Yeah.
There's no exception.
For it to rise again on college campuses and Twitter.
Yeah. I think Adam Smith, he was the one who said that bad ideas go to university to linger because they're untested.
Yep.
It's unbelievable. Reading even the things I had read even before the podcast about this particular time in history, it's the same questions, it's the same gut-wrenching horror internally that I had when reading about the Holocaust and the evil that people are capable of. And that's what drove my first question, actually, John, because I'm trying to think at a certain point, these people committing these atrocities just obviously became desensitized to them.
Yeah.
To the point where I don't believe they were doing it for a greater cause anymore. I think that they were doing it because they enjoyed it.
I think so. I don't want to say that's certainly what was happening, but I think it's either you are so much a robot that you do whatever you're told or you're enjoying it. It's either out of ignorance or it's out of intent, any human action.
So with that in mind, as this continued to progress over the course of the years, how did the propaganda used change, or did it change? And I ask that because at first, what you said earlier, they're painting this picture of this utopia where everybody's going to be agrarian, you know, and we will take care of you. Well, as people are being mass murdered, sometimes brutally, how did the propaganda change, or did they even need it anymore?
That's a good question. I'm trying to remember. I don't think they actually even bothered with propaganda by 1978-79 when it comes to we're remaking society. By that point, the war with Vietnam is gathering, and a lot of the propaganda shifts from a collectivist to a nationalist message where we need to invade and liberate the three ethnically Cambodian provinces of Vietnam. So the collectivist message shifts away from here's the glories of socialism and communism to here is the glory of a war to strengthen and unify the Cambodian people.
Okay. So the old purpose wasn't served anymore, so they repurposed the propaganda.
Yeah, I mean, propaganda is always shifting.
What was the role of art and culture in this regime? Obviously, it was affected or it had an effect as being used in propaganda. I don't know, I'm asking.
Well, artists and writers and people like that, they were among those targeted. So Cambodian culture basically dies for many years. It is no longer about telling stories. It is no longer about writing music that elevates the soul. It is no longer about painting beautiful images or doing anything other than glorifying the state. That's something else that every collectivist revolutionary government has in common. It suppresses and remolds culture into what it believes is useful. It is ultimately utilitarian. And if you are, again, as we've talked about many times, if you are not useful, you go.
So it's not at all about the individual expression. In fact, that's
that's
what they want to fight
illegal
against.
Illegal in most collective societies.
So you can express yourself as long as it is in praise of the state.
No, you can express praise of the state. You don't get to express yourself.
Okay.
You express what I tell you to express. Mm. We should try that on the podcast. I'm going to tell you what to write about for the rest of the season.
Yeah.
Let's see how that goes. Yeah, you guys will be bored out of your minds.
No, what would happen is you would take all the interesting topics and you would give me, Joe, I need you to write a podcast on cardboard.
Correct. The interesting history of IKEA pegboard bookshelves, as yes. I'm looking at one right now. And there's a point to be made there, Joe. It's utilitarian art, rational art, whatever term you want to use for this communist art, is ultimately boring. Read communist literature, the literature that was quote unquote approved. Read Nazi literature. Read fascist literature. It's awful because it's not about expressing genuinely held beliefs. It's not about ideas. It's like reading a homework assignment. Not my students, of course, but most.
No, of course not.
Yeah, I am being told to write about this, so I'm going to write it in the most stale, boring, just get it done kind of language possible. There is no art, there is no beauty, there is no joy or love in the literature of a communist or collective society. And yet, weirdly, a lot of artists love communism.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of comfortable Western artists who have to invent their traumas.
I always say this in professional circles, everybody loves concepts.
Yeah.
Concepts are fun because there's no consequences with a concept. Everyone loves to stay in the conceptual stage. The challenge is that concepts are worthless until you put them into action. And when they're put into action is when you realize if they have any merit or not.
And if they do, but there are problems, you adjust.
You adjust, you pivot.
But you can't.
You compensate. Sometimes,
with this kind of ideology.
Yeah, sometimes an idea is just bad and you say, this isn't going to work. So to your point just now, it's like, yeah, this doesn't allow for any pivots or any changes because it's not about solving problems. It's about pushing an agenda. So it is 1, 2, 3, 4. We will follow these steps regardless of how effective or terrible they are.
I would amend that to say it's not about solving real problems. It's about pushing an agenda that solves perceived problems in society. But you don't look at the genuine problems that are being created as you're fixing all of these perceived wealth inequality or an unequal distribution of land or something along those lines.
Yeah. How did Cambodia rebuild itself after this?
It still is.
Horror.
I mean, when you lose a quarter of your population in 4 years, it is still recovering.
I don't just mean the population, though. I mean, how did it rediscover its voice? You talked about the artists and the writers all being dead.
Yeah.
Who took up the mantle? Did they find libraries that had been missed? Like, what happened? I guess here's my question. What happened after this group was pushed out of power? I know that they continue to fight, but did Cambodia at the time start to rebuild immediately, or were they just in like shell shock for a while?
They were in shell shock really until the end of the Cold War. I mean, the Vietnamese are in some ways helping the Cambodians recover, but I don't want to make it sound like the Vietnamese were, you know, kind and gentle liberators. They were just as vicious, but towards smaller groups of people. They purged dissidents just as effectively as the Khmer Rouge did, but they viewed a smaller percentage of the population as dissidents. And honestly, most of them were already dead.
Mm-hmm.
So again, comparatively, the Vietnamese had the gentler hand than the Khmer Rouge did. I don't know too much about post-Khmer Cambodian literature. My brain's hard drive only has so much space. So I can't speak with authority on how its culture recovered. I know that it took 2 decades for its economy and for its political system to kind of stabilize. And in many ways, they're still recovering. But as far as culturally, I would imagine a lot of the post-Khmer Cambodian artistic expressions have great similarities with Vietnamese artistic expressions from the same period. I would imagine that the Vietnamese use this opportunity to kind of either, quote, help out or reshape Cambodian culture to be more closely aligned with their own.
Mm. In comparing the Vietnamese to the Khmer Rouge, it seems like it's an apples and oranges comparison because to your point, a lot of the people that the Vietnamese communists would have purged were already gone.
Yes.
So it's not the same comparison between the two groups.
In terms of how they ruled?
Yes.
Yeah. But they were both communist. Again, I don't want to make it sound like they were bringing freedom and democracy.
That's my point, is that would they have enacted something as terrible? I mean, we saw that in as they went south in Vietnam, the same type of purges happened at times, if not worse.
Yeah.
I think that the accelerated timeline of the Khmer Rouge was more shocking because it seemed like it was a snowball effect. Yeah. They just started to kill more and faster and faster and faster and faster. Mm-hmm. If they had been left unchecked, if they had not started a war with Vietnam, would they have wiped out the entire country?
You know, there's the rhetoric that came about. One of the passages in the quote, the extensive quote that I read at the beginning of the podcast, really stuck with me and still sticks with me. Tita Butmam was told by one of the guards that we can accomplish the communist revolution with two people, one in power and one doing all the work. Mm. So unless reality hit the Khmer Rouge government, I would imagine they would have kept going. I don't know if they would have killed everyone, but I think they would have killed so many people that Cambodia would have become the best example of pure communism possible. A ruling elite that lives in unimaginable luxury and hundreds of thousands or millions of slaves. Because that's what communism creates. Mm.
John, I have a closing question, and this is going to probably remind you of how we've ended a few of these types of podcasts where we're talking about an individual or group that is responsible for such atrocity. Mm-hmm. How can we identify the warning signs of genocide? That's the end result. Mm-hmm. Obviously, those, by the time it gets to that point, it's a little too late, but taking huge steps back, the beginnings of what the genocide will eventually be, the people causing it, their overall cause, their why. What are some ways we can see that ahead of time and respond appropriately?
Well, respond appropriately will depend on the political and social conditions in your country. As far as the warning signs, those are pretty universal. And the question is familiar because we've talked about it repeatedly and it bears repeating. I mean, this is kind of the greatest hits moment of this season. You want to start with an understanding that most evil people don't start off as evil. They don't start off with concentration camps and gulags and converting high schools into what became tool slang. It starts with, A, as Gustav Gilbert said, a lack of empathy. If you see people who are genuinely not, oh, I'm trying to be edgy, you know, when you're a young person, but who genuinely don't feel empathy when they hurt someone, whether it's physically or emotionally, psychologically, and they just do not care, that is a huge warning sign that you're dealing with a sociopath or a psychopath. And then if you get enough of them who have power over society, that starts down the road to this kind of regime that can, not will, but can put people into concentration camps, that can deport people to gulags, that can send men and women into killing fields. That's one thing. You also have to look at ideas. I am a firm believer that any idea that rejects not God per se, but rejects any concept of divine authority, however you define it, an authority outside this world that sets boundaries on your morals and your actions, and that says there are consequences for your actions. In other words, any ideology that is rooted in secular humanism that says humanity is the summit of all creation and the summit of that organization or of that society is government. If there is an ideology that says look to government for your solutions, that is dangerous. On the right, on the left, history has shown us that governments are, yes, very good at solving some problems, but very, very terrible at solving other problems. Government is a hammer. It is a toolbox with one tool, and it uses force, military, police, civil, legal force to compel not you to change your attitudes and your beliefs. It doesn't encourage people, hey, let's think through this problem and come up with a solution. It says, do this, or I will fine you, I will imprison you, I will deport you, I will kill you. When you blend that with an ideology that says there are no consequences, eternal, lasting consequences, that's another, I think, marker of evil.
Mm.
And then third, I think you have to look at basic social mores. All of us, even the most morally relativistic person in a society, understands there are some things that are fundamentally true and some things that are fundamentally false. We may disagree over definitions. We may disagree over the extent to which that truth is applied from a personal or a societal or a moral standpoint. We all understand that some things are fundamentally true. If you have an ideology, if you have a worldview, if you have a political system, an economic system, an educational system that says, no, something that we all have known was true is actually not true, is actually false, that things that are biologically or socially or politically or factually one way, no, it's actually the other. That is another marker of a, I won't say an evil regime, but a dangerous worldview. If you can define something, if you can redefine one thing, that train of thought leads you to redefine anything. Merge that with government. And all governments operate on something called precedent. Once the government does something, it will tend to continue to do that until it is stopped forcibly, whether by a court or by an invading army. Well, who are we going to turn to for definitions in this society where we have unmoored ourselves from universal absolute truth? Let's turn to government. We can't turn to God, can't turn to the church, can't turn to schools, can't turn to parents, because they're not at the summit of creation. Government is. Let's let government redefine things. Once government defines something, it can then redefine it. And then let's put people in that government who have no empathy for the real, genuine concerns of men and women who live under their rule. Whether you are talking about ancient tyrannies, like what we talked about early in this season, under Xerxes and under Sennacherib and under the Inquisition, or you're talking about modern tyrannies like Hitler, Stalin, Mao Zedong, Pol Pot, Anthony Fauci, whatever, a society that allows people who don't care about their fellow men to be in positions of power in a government that has no restrictions on it and are given the power to redefine basic fundamental tenets, not of right and wrong, but of human existence, that I think is the best recipe for an evil regime.
Thank you for joining us for the discussion on the Khmer Rouge. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. And if you would like to make this podcast even better, please go to our website, 15minutehistorypodcast.org, and hit the support button. Thank you, and see you next week.